You are tuned into Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
This evening, I am joined by someone that I really, really look up to quite a lot. And I think I do have some of the questions that we did get from some people who were interested, of course, and we shared those with her. But just to get a sense a little bit about who she is the founder of Township Press Africa, a writer, speaker, mentor, and social justice activist. She trained as a financial journalist and brings expertise spanning over 14 years working across various sectors as a communication, media, and stakeholder professional. Her work advances social and economic justice, upholding the overall cohort of human rights for development across the African continent, that is Mali, Kenya, Namibia, Congo, the US, and of course in Europe. Now, Jabulile's passion for social justice has led her to leading key guest lectures at the University of Houston, Texas, in the United States of America, and also at the Pan-African Parliament. One that I also want to visit, hey? Definitely one that I would like to visit, the Pan-African Parliament and the University of Pretoria, just amongst others. She is passionate about mentorship and leadership. Over the past 16 years, she has been supporting young industry leaders in building the continent through Africa-inspired ideas, conversations, and solutions. Of course, if you do follow her on Instagram, for instance, you would have been part of those. I certainly have joined some of the lives that she has done. She currently serves as the non-executive board member of the Prof. Musa Manzi Foundation and is a member of Backchat Sessions, chaired by Minister of the Presidency for Youth Monitoring Evaluation Cluster Minister. It is quite an extensive, I think, biography, and I think it summarizes what I think is what we could go on and on and on and on for days. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Tapelo. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. How was your day?
Today was a bit difficult.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we are still here, I suppose, by the grace of God. And despite everything else, eh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, we thank the Lord. And thank you so much once again for joining us. I was looking forward to this conversation, I must say. And I think a lot of our listeners as well, some of the questions that you actually got, we're looking at that as well. But it is certainly a conversation that I think a lot of us have been looking forward to. Now, I personally think, you know, that we can read biographies, we can read books and all that. They're very important, and I suppose they do have their own place. But it's always good to hear it from the person themselves. I know personally I struggle with that question. And people say, can you please tell us who you are? I'm like, ha, guys, like, where do I start? You know, because obviously it's a very, very difficult question. But I thought it would be very important for people who might not know Osis Jabulile. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, it's a very odd one, isn't it?
Yeah, like, I know, right?
Difficult to talk about yourself, but I mean, in a nutshell, Jabulile is I love justice.
Yeah.
I am an African black woman who's very passionate in everything I do.
Yeah.
Always have been. So in every single sphere of my functioning, whether it's work or my heart work, as I call it, which is my passion.
Okay.
We'll always find one thing, and that's just my passion and my signature of a person who is always keen on social justice and also the development and the advancement of our continent. I think you may have known this by now. I absolutely love our continent, and I am an apologetic Pan-Africanist. I think I blame my father for that, but that is essentially who I am. But I'm a sister, a daughter, a wife, and a friend, among all the other things about professions, and a child of God, of course.
And a child of God. You said the hard work, not hard work, with H-A-R-D. Am I understanding you well?
Very right, yeah, hard work. So that's what I call some of my passion projects, like this is from the heart, you know. This is not a job. It's hard work.
Yeah. So it comes from the heart more than anything else. I think that's very interesting. And is there a difference? I'd love to explore that concept because it's the first time I hear it, and I'm thinking I'm not the only one who's heard about it, because we're always told, work hard, work hard, work hard. And every time we hear those words, work hard, it's almost like we always go up and like, that word again. So it's refreshing to hear heart work. So how do we, how do we differentiate the two, just as a way to clarify for some of our listeners and myself included?
So, I mean, you know, at some point we all need to work hard as people.
Yeah.
You know, establishing, we are trying to advance ourselves professionally,
mm-hmm.
and just generally as people, you know. I think also even in hard work itself, one has to still define it clearly. What is hard work? Does hard work to you mean that you wait all night, working cross night studying? You know, if that's what hard work is to you, to somebody else, hard work could simply mean being able to be smart enough with your time management, maybe, and your projects, being able to align them nicely in a way to navigate both your purpose and your work with other job. But hard work to me is the type of work that doesn't necessarily come with a paycheck.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, it's probably one of the hardest, really, because, you know, nobody has asked you to do any of this. You are inspired, and there you are trying to save the world, trying to do good and really just advance both people and your community or society. And it takes your all, but in a degrading way or in an exhausting way, but in a way empowering and uplifting to you as well, which I think for me is the greatest fulfillment. I think there's no price that no price tag necessary for that, because you sleep better, you are empowering people who you don't even know. Some don't tell you, some forget, but the impact you make for me is so significant. So I'm always on the camp of the hard work folks.
Yeah.
When that hard work, we work hard, then I guess it helps us.
I love that, because I remember I know someone personally who has said, you know, you can't save the whole world, and I think at that time there was a particular place I was going to, and I was like, you know what, I think we are misaligned a little bit with the place where I was going to. And my friend was like, but you can't save the whole world. So it sounds like, you know, we need to get to a certain point where we realize that even though we can't save the whole world, but you can save the little spaces that you are in. Am I taking it a little bit too far here?
In fact, you're correct, because that's the philosophy I live by. If you cannot impact your society, if you cannot start with your street, where you come from, wherever you may be, some of us have left where we came from years ago because of in pursuit of careers and work and other things.
Yeah.
But if you can't change even where you live,
Or
when I mean change, I don't mean bring people electricity and water. Local government.
Yeah.
But I mean, if your gifting is not in any way impactful to the people around you, immediate people around you, you need to sit down and ask yourself some serious questions, because what are you doing and who is benefiting from what you're doing? Especially if you are a Christian professional or a Christian leader, you then need to ask yourself, what exactly has God called you to do and to be in the world and in the marketplace? And that has to be very clear, because over and above being professionals and leaders, we are being called to serve. Not just Christ, but also each other. And as we serve each other, the world is watching, and so is Christ himself. So it's never about you alone.
Impact
other people, and it's actually always for the greater good of everybody else.
Yeah, I think a lot of us don't think about it in that fashion. And so that's why I was like, we need to just entertain this a little bit more, because I think we need more of those. We have become a society that's just about me, and everything is about me. And we just don't care about people in our communities and how we impact them. And we sort of come up with these excuses that you can't save the world, and no one is saying you must save the world. But like you're correctly saying, you need to start with where you are, influence the change where you are. And I think think that's quite a very, very important question. But I just wanted to take you back a little bit as well. Where do you come from, and what are some of the challenges that you had to face growing up?
So I, strange enough, do not come from KZN.
Okay.
You're always shocked, like, you thought you, I'm like, my surname, I know.
Yes.
My surname will make you think, anyway, I'm not, I'm that different Zulu who does not come from KZN.
Okay, okay.
I was born and raised in Klerksdorp, which is a very small conservative town in the Northwest Province.
Okay.
In a township called Jobidina, well, now they call it Matosana,
yeah.
The city of Matosana.
Yeah.
And that's where I was born and raised until I was literally a teenager. My grandparents, surrounded by plenty of aunts, my parents, they've always been Joburgers, so they, stayed in Joburg, but I was raised by my grandparents. I think my grandparents felt like, you guys are such a young couple, go and enjoy yourselves and enjoy your marriage. You just give us this little person, we'll help you out.
Oh, okay.
And I think they did an amazing job. So
yeah.
I then came to Johannesburg in my teens.
Okay.
I came with my parents literally as a teenager at the age of 13.
Yeah.
And that's how I got to this crazy city. But I do have family in spread across Mpumalanga and KZN, of course.
Nice.
And many other places, Ermelo. And yeah, I have some genes in me that are also of the diaspora nature.
Yes.
So I have a grandfather who's Malawian.
Yeah.
A mom who is Tswana.
Oh, nice.
Born in South Africa. My father is Zulu. So I have an interesting Pan-African lineage, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. And growing up, what are some of the challenges you might have faced?
I think for me, and it's really not unique, I think I've had to grow up being a person who struggled a lot with low self-esteem.
Okay.
Because I was slightly darker, not than everybody else, slightly darker than the rest of my friends, and I struggled a lot with my confidence. I think that for me is the one glaring challenge that I literally faced when I was growing up, because I've had to do so much work in that regard.
Yeah.
So I was always the brainy one in terms of having the loud mouth, the loudest mouth. Even in church, I'm up there doing your Sabbath school, talking, running lessons, teaching lessons, and just really just out there. I suppose understood that I was not different or unique. I think those words themselves are problematic, but my parents were very affirming to my character. So, I mean, from day one, I've always been affirmed as beautiful, smart, capable. And people may see this as some sense of arrogance, but this is what my family has helped me through. My aunts, everybody, in fact, I think my family, I always say, my family, perhaps to some extent, they're not good for me, because in front of them, in their eyes, I could even be the president.
Yes. That's beautiful, though.
I think that's just the amount of belief they have in me.
Yeah.
I think it's good, though, because it has helped me shape myself and not really rely much on external validation from people. So I've always been grown up to be have a very thick skin and be clear about what I want and not be confused about, I want to do this, I'm not sure. I've always been clear. This is the path I want to take. This is the career I wish to be in. And that's exactly the career I'm in. And because they equally thought so, except perhaps one of the parents who felt, you could be a great engineer or lawyer. And I mean, I had no passion in any of that.
Yeah.
I rolled a little bit into engineering while trying to listen to them.
Yeah.
I studied some mechanical engineering and did well with my engineering maths and drawing, but quickly got bored because I was like, why am I lying to myself? Because I literally torture waking up to go to this technical college. And quickly had to just start my writing and just get into my journalism space and just be myself.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to unpack that a little bit because I think there's really some interesting things to note there. But the confidence one, and I just want to venture onto that one a little bit more because I think it's something, like you said, that a lot of us do struggle with growing up, I suppose, as young people. You know, the confidence thing is always a problem. And just like you, I shared darker skin color as well. And I think for a very long while, up until recently, I suppose there's this now thing about tall, dark, and handsome and all those sort of stuff. But we never had that. And so being dark-skinned, you always felt like, you know, you're the oddest one out. And there's always that level of esteem that's, you know, you look at yourself down as compared to others. And I'm thinking there could be some young people who are also struggling with that right now. And I loved the part where you mentioned that your family played a very important role in helping you to build your own self-esteem. How important then is family, or I suppose those affirmations by people who are close to us when we feel a little bit down or less confident?
Yeah, I think the role of family, Tapelo, is crucial. It's actually everything. It's a make or break. Because these are people who you come from. These are people whom you belong to. These are people within whom your identity is enshrined to. So you cannot just divorce them or ignore them or deny them. You know, they are you, right? No matter what structure or feature, whether they're rich or poor, you come from these people. Part of these people is a lineage that belongs to you. So what they say does play a role, which is why whatever they say, if at all, they have to always try to be as positive as they possibly can to help, you know, us, to help young people. This is, I think, the role of parents, aunts, uncles, everybody within and around whom children are growing up in. What you say to children, what you and how you say it to them, I think, has a lot to do with how far they'll go, and what are some of the things they'll internalize in terms of their confidence and just how they see themselves and what they believe they're capable in, or they're not capable in. So it's not just the role of church or teachers or some strangers that we meet later on in life who become mentors and spiritual sisters or spiritual brothers and all of that stuff. You must get that at home. And not everybody does. I'm aware of that because of our socioeconomic feature, the architecture of our communities and our families as well. I mean, we have some very dysfunctional families. And I mean, not really environments, but anybody would want to grow up in as a teenager or a young child or even a young adult. So I think it's the responsibility of churches as well to not just focus on hiding our heads in the sand with our entire body out there thinking, oh, you know, we're inspiring young people, but are we really inspiring them? Or just each other as people, as are we edifying the body of Christ? Or by how we relate to each other, how we see each other and what we say about each other, because that's affirmation or that is destroy. You know, we can either be destroying each other or affirming each other, especially as black people. I always take it back to saying, especially as black people, because I'm black, and my experiences and thoughts would always come from a premise of a black person, because I cannot speak on behalf of anybody else. I only know how to be black. I grew up black. So my spectacle is that of blackness. So it's important for us to be building each other as well, because we are also known to have been indoctrinated to believe that our blackness is problematic. That we need to be within the body of Christ to be washed away of this blackness. It's as if when you come to Christ, you have to remove this blackness and become some, I don't know what is it, so that he can see you, hear you, and accept you. And this is a fallacy. God made us black in the first place. We're black because he chose that we'll be black. And it's not a mistake. And we should not try to rectify it, because we made a mistake. And we are made in his image. So we are equally important, equally capable. We are not substandard. And it's important that we need to get rid of this colonized talk amongst each other. because our children are listening. This is the kind of talk that goes around lunchtime on Sabbath around our table. This is generally at picnics when we're talking about so-and-so and how we are so quick to degrade anything that is black or any progressive person, because for some reason, if it's progressing and if it's brilliant and good, it cannot be attached to black or a black person. That is problematic because that's regressive behavior.
Yeah.
We need to get rid of that as soon as possible, specifically as people who are Christian.
Yeah.
Because we have a much greater task to do on earth. So it's very petty for us to be functioning at that level with that kind of mentality.
Sure. That's really fair. I love that point because almost everything that has a black connotation is almost like negative. The black sheep in the family, we have that black tax, you know. So it's almost like there's always a negative connotation to being black as well. And also, if you think about, you know, when you talk about celebrating leaders like yourselves, you know, we almost have this prefix that says black excellence, as if excellence itself has a color, whatever the case might be. So I love that point that you're making there, that we need to rectify how we think. Excellence, I suppose, is excellence. It doesn't have to necessarily be black, as if there's a problem with, I suppose, as it were, quote unquote, a black person that is, I suppose, exudes excellence in whatever that they do. You know, we should celebrate them for being excellent in what they do. So I really love that point, and that's the message that I'm getting there. Now, I just wanted to ask this very question, which also came out quite very well as we were preparing for this one, that does background play some sort of influence in shaping one's perspective about life, their own life? So I'm thinking about a young person who is listening right now, probably somewhere in the rurals of, you know, somewhere in KZN or Matlosana or somewhere in Kitwe in Zambia, and they might be confined to their environment. Their perspective of life, does it necessarily, you know, have a huge bearing on their environment, or one can rise beyond that?
It really does, but in two ways. Mm-hmm. I always like the beginning of the year with this whole matriculant newspaper story.
Yeah.
Because that's when you also get to get a sense of our community and how we gauge our actual success, right? Mm. But just to borrow from that experience, there are people who would get straight A's, about 7-8 of them, which is beyond even a matric and a university exemption.
Mm.
When you trace their backgrounds, you'll read the news and they'll be interviewed and you'll hear that they were apparently studying with candles and stories, like sometimes there were no lights, one is being raised only by a grandmother.
Yeah.
In fact, a recent story was that KZN, a young man who graduated from university who was being raised by his grandmother.
Yes.
So I helped him get a job. And those are stories that often would come up when we kind of hit success or the level of success or when our potential officially begins to showcase us and our talents to the world.
Mm.
When people start digging, they realize, oh, she comes, as they would put it, she comes from nothing or he comes from nothing. But those are not all the stories of black people.
Mm.
There are some of us, or some people who come from struggling but very progressive backgrounds where, you know, our parents, our grandparents would give everything they had. They were not educated. They were not well-versed with PhDs. Some were taxi drivers, some were nurses, teachers, some were just unemployed or domestic work, whatever it is. They made sure that whatever they would put together was to help you get into a private school or any other ordinary school so you can do better than what they could do.
Yeah.
There's whatever setup it is, whether you come from the other side of the LSM, which has no clue what all these things are all about, and they just come from a place where they have drivers and chefs in the house. And I mean, there's different scenarios.
Yeah,
we may be black, but our stories are not the same.
Mm.
All of that defines us because that's what shaped you. And what do I mean it shaped you? Because you grew up around it.
Mm.
If you grew up in a place where everything was done for you, you couldn't even, you know, wash your own dish because you knew that the maid will do it for
you.
You couldn't even lift a finger to rinse a spoon because you know there's somebody who's paid to do that for you. That's going to shape how you treat other people.
Mm.
That's going to shape how you see and relate to other people because you come from what you know.
Mm.
And it's nobody's fault. That was your upbringing. That's what you grew up seeing. You can only operate from the premise of knowing what you grew up with.
Mm.
Similar to somebody who grew up with nothing, they can only see the world through those eyes and either seek to to want more and better or continue on the same trajectory. So same as a person who grew up having all of it, they can also choose to either do better than they had, even though what they had was all of it, or digress and choose to do drugs and be nothing because you don't really care how money is made. You come from it and you know, like a prodigal son, each time you keep going back, you'll be embraced and have money. So we are shaped by all of that. You can't say my background doesn't shape me. However, what we should say is that it does not define us. It certainly shapes us, but it does not define us. So because I used to study with a candle, I'm not defined by that. But it has shaped my perspective of how to be diligent, how to either study fast, or because I know how to economize. Because it's a candle, it could finish any time. How do I be smart about this thing? Or I could be shaped by, I know there's lights all the time, and really, I mean, I have nothing to worry about, and probably even fail because everything is at my disposal. That also shapes you. So I always say to young people, whatever it is, it's nobody's fault that you grew up with nothing. This one grew up with everything, because that was our parents, and according to what they could afford, that's what they're supposed to give us based on what they could afford. What you want to do is define yourself away from all of that, whether it was good or bad, away from it. Even if you come from millions, away from it. Who are you? Define yourself away from the millions. If you come from nothing, define yourself away from nothing and start building a different legacy which belongs to you, created by you, not your parents. I've never been fascinated by people thriving on parents' legacy. You know, it's a personal opinion. There's nothing wrong with it, and you're quite lucky if you have those. But it's yours. I guess thanks to your surname, but it's not yours. I have a lot of respect and regard for somebody who built something of their own. Because then it's yours. You're building it from scratch. And for me, that's a leader. And if you're going to take on a legacy, then even build it further and take it further to where it was before, then maybe I could throw you out. So that's just my thinking around that area.
I love that. That, you know, yes, you might be born in that environment, but it doesn't define you, right? It might shape your perspective, but it doesn't obviously define you. So really, really love that. So how did you meet Christ, if I may ask? And what was happening?
You know, to be honest, there was really nothing dramatic. I was 13 years old. We were a bunch of friends at a church in Soweto, the church I grew up going to in Orlando West, Seventh-day Adventist Church. And we thought, together as friends, as teenagers, I think it was an age group of about 14, 15, 16. So let's all get baptized because the elder has announced the next baptism. And, you know, it was not just the rush of, let's do it as friends. We were quite dedicated in work. I remember as young as that, we used to do Sabbath school, and I was in the youth choir. So it was just fitting because I was so solid in this thing, and I would always look forward to church on Friday, you know, after school, the whole week, and I just always look forward to Sabbath. I loved God, and I remember, I know it's so weird right now because I sound like literally Sister White, but I used to read my Bible in my teens. And back then, we were living in Protea North in Soweto, and I remember in my room, I used to just read, and I would pray to God about how I wanted to be a person who's influential. I didn't use the word influential back then, but I remember specifically saying to God in my prayers, like, please make me a big person. I want to be loved by people. So I can show them what it is to be, you know, like a Christian person who's famous. I guess I wanted to be famous at that time. And then I attempted some auditions for Kideo, to which I didn't make because I was told I was too shy and I spoke too soft. Because I thought, you know, I've prayed about this thing. Let me you know, take some action. And my parents took me to Orlando East to this promotions casting agency for television to audition for Kideo. And and there it's when it started with the whole confidence thing. She's too spoken, she's too soft spoken, and she's short. And she just doesn't have the loudness and the rowdiness we need for camera. And, you know, you can imagine the internal work that went on there, which helped because my family was pretty solid and have always told me that I was anything I wanted to be and I could be it. So And I think for me, I remember my dad vividly saying to me, "Ah, well, it's just one thing. Maybe you can get the next one, you know, just continue with your youth activities." I've always loved God. I think the interesting thing is the journey, though, when I started growing older, when I started having this love-hate relationship with now that I'm getting to know this guy, I may have some few questions for him. I don't think I understand him all the time. I think when I started adulting really, really hard, I started having this friction with him where sometimes I don't pray or sometimes I really don't think he cares. And you know, all this roller coaster of faith, and just start to really read the Bible because I need to understand what this guy actually wants from me, or what should I be doing, and that really the work that a Christian person should be doing in trying to really understand what God wants out of you. And I think that's when I then grew in faith. So maybe I could say it wasn't when I got baptized when I was a teenager. But when I started adulting and started doing life seriously, and I just needed to hear him out, and I felt like he wasn't hearing me, then I got to learn to say, okay, I think this is how this guy operates, and I don't think I could ever understand it 100%, but the least I'm going to do is just abide in him, trust him, and just keep walking one step at a time.
Yeah, I think we all go through that at some stage, I suppose, you know, when you're like, like you said, this guy, you know, you're trying to understand what's happening. You're like, but I pray, but I give out tithes. Almost sounds like that guy in Luke chapter 18. I give out tithes, I do this and that, and then we kind of count and start counting, you know, why is he not doing this and that? And that love-hate relationship that you mentioned, I think a lot of us do go through that. But it's a beautiful narration that you've made that kind of reminds us as well, you know, that you know, as you got to read more, understand more what the Lord wants and how he operates, kind of made things a little bit easier. Now, I just wanted us to move then a little bit in the interest of time to journalism. It sounds like your parents, like you said, they wanted you to do engineering and you did it for them, but you had a passion for journalism. I'm suspecting at the time it wasn't such a popular profession for black people.
It wasn't. In fact, to be specific, it was mining engineering that I was meant to get into. And I started with mechanical engineering. Because at the time, mainly my uncle, actually, he was a mining engineer himself. He used to work at the mines, quite a senior guy back then, at the Orkney Stilfontein mines in Klerksdorp. Doing very well, the guy had money, you know, brilliant, smart scholar, maths, you know, the works. And he was like, "Do you know at work how many females I work with?" I said, "No." He said, 0.1%.
Oh, wow. Okay. Virtually no women.
He didn't even waste any time. He said to me, "You could make so much money, buy yourself a beautiful car, big house. There's literally no females in this thing. Just get into this thing." And that was purely the motivation. And I think as I was doing it, I then felt, I didn't even go far, it was just year one, I figured, but I just can't. It's not because I was failing. I actually did well. I mean, engineering, drawing, which actually even was my favorite. The math was a problem, it has always been, I think, high school. But I somehow was managing, and I figured, I don't want this. I don't want to see myself, you know, underground with that yellow hat and a light in front of the forehead with safety boots. And that's not me. That's not me. The me is me talking too much, writing things down, chasing people for their stories, or not even chasing, but actually curating and writing them. Because even journalism was just a start for me to get in. But I've always known I wanted to control the sector. And this is why eventually I even got into publishing, because I didn't just want to be a storyteller, but also a bridge for storytellers. So beyond writing the story, I wanted to build a bridge for other storytellers, because I believe how important it is for us to tell our stories. Hence my platform to create more writers to tell their stories.
That's lovely. And where did you practice as a journalist?
So I did my internship with Financial Mail, Business Day, Sunday Times, The Sowetan. That's where I started. At the time, it was called Avusa Media. Then it changed to Times Media. Now it's Diso Black Star, I think. They still have the whole Sunday Times and Business Day thing. And, you know, I trained in the financial genre. So I practiced as a... I trained as a financial journalist because what I actually wanted was to follow the African reporting beat.
Okay.
And at the time, it wasn't there.
Mm.
So I could not see myself reporting on politics.
Mm.
That beat was there. That's not me.
Mm.
It will never be me.
Mm.
And then I jumped politics, reporting into politics, and I opted to do rather business news, because there was no African beat.
Mm.
And that's how I got into journalism. And I loved it because I knew that if I do business news, company news, I'm closer to talking about the issues in the continent.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually I'll find my way into African storytelling.
Mm.
So that's how the story has kind of started, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Is history, yeah. I'm sure you enjoyed yourselves at these publications.
I did. Yeah. My it was lovely. However, again, because of how you were raised and made to believe that you are capable of a lot of bigger and greater things, I did not last much in the sector because I wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
I quickly jumped out of the traditional media space and I went into corporate because I also realized my subtle passion for communications for industry.
Mm.
And I wanted to get into that space. And I think, as you would know, a lot of communication officers in the corporate space are former journalists.
Yeah.
So it was an easy fit for me to join the private and corporate sector to then build a profession as a stakeholder person in a media and communication
professional. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay, which leads us beautifully into Township Press. Why and when?
Yeah. So Township Press, I always tell people, we started being visible 2 years ago, but we've been there on paper since 2017.
Oh.
And if you look at all our branding, it'll tell you that we were established in 2017.
Yes.
But we were not sure of our signature yet. So I knew the kind of niche I wanted, which is why I established it in the first place.
Mm.
But we were not ready for the sector yet.
Mm.
So I stalled.
Mm.
And part of the stalling was because I had doubts.
Mm.
I wasn't sure if it will be feasible for us. Mm. Is it a proper sector? There's no money in publishing, by the way.
Mm.
So from day one, I've always known that this is purely going to be for advancing other people's dreams. Not But which is why it cannot be the only thing that
you
do.
Yeah.
I call it a heart project.
Yeah.
Because here we advance the dreams of others more than we advance my dreams or visions. But I guess the dream of telling African stories is realized. So that's enough. But our first title was launched in the height of COVID.
Mm.
In fact, I'm very grateful to COVID on the contrary, because it birthed us, because we were all stuck in houses, couldn't move, couldn't hug our loved ones.
So we had to read.
All we could do was read and write.
Yeah.
And that's how we finally got to exist, because then I had an author whom I launched during the height of COVID. And I think after that book one, which was a brilliant story, we've never looked back ever since. We're growing stronger by the day.
Mm. That's beautiful. And when you then found your niche, and I suppose, there could be other people maybe who want to launch their own, and might not be really a publishing company or anything like that. They might want to do their own businesses somewhere. And you're talking about a niche. So it kind of sounds like, you know, you need to know who your people are, who your target market is. How did you then land at who your niche was?
It was very simple for me because I first of all saw how I was treated as an aspiring writer in the sector. I got some serious loans. The sector is not easy. For some reason, you need to have some level of influence in terms of popularity and social media currency, which I think is completely nonsensical, but that is the mediocre standard of the industry.
Yeah.
And I wanted to change that territory because I found that it was literary injustice.
Mm.
It was literary injustice.
Mm.
You cannot confine literature with those classes and boundaries.
Mm.
You certainly cannot do this to a black community.
Mm.
A bunch of scholars, thinkers, shapers, readers, you cannot just exclude that community, because then if you exclude us, we will continue to have our stories written and channeled by white publishing houses. Mm. That is a problem.
Mm.
It has always been a problem, and it has not stopped, and it is still a problem.
Mm.
It is a problem that many people do not want to talk about, but it is a problem, which is why as black publishers, it's important for us to come up to the fore and take up space in our own right and publish stories of our own people to advance our own lived realities and communicate our own freedoms in our own tone and use our own black-lit channels to distribute these books with black-owned retail bookstores.
Yeah.
So it's an entire value chain. I'm not saying we should get rid of everybody else.
Yep.
I mean, they're so big that you can't even touch them anyway,
yeah,
even if we wanted to.
Yeah.
They're a solid dominant of the market.
Sure.
So you can't even touch them, and you can't demand anything out of them.
Sure.
And I've never been a person of that type of gospel too much and want other people's things.
Mm.
But I believe in building an alternative route because I have power to that. So I can build an alternative route so I can create what I want to see and move right alongside them and probably irritate them or inspire them, whichever way.
Yeah.
But I'll be there.
Yeah.
And they will know it. And that's partly our philosophy over and above everything else.
Sure. So is it true that if you want to hide something, put it in a book?
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I think there was a time in our lives when that notion was true.
Yes.
Because it was so easy to degrade black people and always speak down on them.
Yeah.
I mean, we come from the era of Steve Biko, Tsitsi Mashinini. We come, even within our church, we've had brilliant minds. Abu Tulankosi, I mean, look, we've got plenty. I know we're not a church that likes to acknowledge our own people, but we come from serious intellectuals just across the Pan-African landscape and globally.
Mm.
We don't come from an empty hub of thinkers.
Yeah.
If anything, I think we've probably had the best.
Yeah.
So I've always found that statement to be a little problematic and actually disrespectful to black people.
Okay.
Things like when you want to hide money, put it in a Bible or a book. I think that's not true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's not true.
All right.
So I think we need to also, we need to learn to somehow stop perpetuating those mediocre statements.
Yes.
I think it started off as a joke. I don't even think it came from black people, but I see black people using it against each other, and I think it's quite sad because I have read since I was 7 years old. My mom, our parents instilled reading in us since we were children. Reading is not something bizarre. We've always read, you know, and we're black. And we equally have no community of people who are readers. So, anyway, it's just one of those silly statements.
Silly statements, indeed. Yeah. I think it was important we raised that to debunk it because, like you said, it is a silly statement that we need to look at and just do away with it. Now, I wanted us then to get into this conversation about money, right? So how would you define your relationship with money?
I would say I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And it's not a perfect one. I did very well in my 20s when I was still growing up and was at the peak of my career and I had everything going for me. And I learned quite a lot. But I then grew up and started adulting seriously again.
Yeah.
And then I started having a bitter relationship with it because of the mistakes I had made in my 20s. Or late 20s, rather.
Yeah.
So, but what I like is the fact that one has to learn. And I think it's important, again, as a black community to learn from our mistakes in terms of, and being honest about those conversations. I've made some serious mistakes and I want to learn from that so I can resolve my finances or my financial situation.
Yeah.
And you can even still have a chance when you get into your 40s or late 30s. Now, that is my story. I'm in that process of resolving, rectifying, and practically doing the works, the hard work behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And it's never been an ugly one to a point of torture, no.
Okay.
But I must say that it was not smooth either. It's been a lesson of a journey of learning.
Yes.
Great learning.
Yeah.
So,
Certainly. Do you mind sharing one or two mistakes? I know that a lot of young people, for instance, when we get our first job, the first thing we think about is buying a car. And we're not necessarily saying that buying a car is wrong, you know, but we don't do it from a principal point of view, understanding your finances and how that eventually will affect you, because we think the cost of buying a car is the installment, only to realize you also have insurance that you must pay. You also have wear and tear to also put into the budget. And all of a sudden, this car now takes about 50-60% of your income, and you start realizing, I can't afford this car anymore. And all of a sudden, we get into financial problems and all that. So we see that as part of, you know, the mistakes that a lot of us do. I suppose perhaps maybe with, because there's not much information about money as we grow up and as we, you know, graduate from university and start our first jobs. So what has been some of those for you?
I think for me, it probably was the, I wouldn't say a car, which was a different, I guess, a typical story we all know and have heard, but probably spending. Spending and maybe overspending, because you feel you have the means, you're a young professional, you have your income coming in, and it's just all these nice zeros, and you also forget to tithe back to the church, and because life is so nice, and you know, the salary that just, it's guaranteed, whether you're sick or not, month end, that SMS religiously it pops in, and you're just in a very relaxed state of affairs about life, because you feel like this is going to be there forever, and you spend recklessly. You know, but of course, I mean, I have a different story as well, again, which I wish one day we can talk about in terms of how we've also supported and helped our families through our success financially. And that was part of my personal story, which was a greater responsibility, which was to take care of things back at home. And that's actually one of the things I was hoping to talk more about, because it was a greater part of who I am in terms of what has shaped me as a young Black woman, because I was literally responsible for, I was literally like a breadwinner at some point, because I had parents who were retrenched and at the same time. And, you know, I think I started adulting way before I was an actual adult in my life. So as much as there's been good lessons, I mean, bad lessons in terms of finances, there's been good ones as well, where one has to accept the responsibility that comes with the idea of coming from a community, the idea of being paid and everybody else being paid because you paid. So if your payday is everybody else's,
it's everyone's payday, right?
You know, everybody must get a portion. You know, and that's, that was a reality for me, specifically my own life. So it's not always about the recklessness of young people and how they waste money and have their cars repossessed because you got so excited and bought a car and you got stuck in the middle and it was taken, or, you know, bought a house or whatever, those typical. And those, all of us still, again, shape us as well. But I'm very keen on talking about the resolve we must make, which is possible, because for as long as you're not 60 years old, I still feel you can resolve yourself and your finances and get back to a stage in your life where you don't need to spend anything, but you could just know that you're okay.
Yeah, okay.
And that you don't have to, you know, when people call you, you start getting some stress or you start sweating. When some certain calls ring,
ignoring them.
I think the better, the greater of us have been through all of that. We've seen it all. We've all been there. And I don't think for me it's anything to, but I would say our focus to want to fix it. So because you know that you're still young and you still have a life ahead of you, and manage it so that you can still do better and again build again. It's not easy or fair, but if you caused the mess, then you can build again. And I think when you build again, there's always a lovely opportunity of building better because you are wiser.
Certainly. I think that will be part two, wink, wink, you know, when we reach out to you once more. We can try and unpack that quite a little bit more. We are certainly just out of time. In 10 seconds or less, any last words to our listeners?
I'd say my last words to whoever's listening, let me start off quickly with young people. I'd say be true to yourself from an early age, whether you're 12, 16, 18, 25, 27, don't wait to be 34 to be true to yourself. I mean, my story is not unique. I always say I was the lucky one because I had an affirming family, but I was always clear about who I am. From the day one, I never used to even fit into any trend or fashion. Some would actually bore me. And that's how odd I was. And I think that was my my strongest point, because I was odd.
Mm.
And I've always been odd. I think to this day I'm still odd.
Yeah.
And that has probably been my I could call it the golden key to my entire life story, because I stayed odd. So firstly, define who you are and stick to that, because that's essentially the start of everything else. And secondly, I'd say trust God. It's not easy. Like I said, it's sometimes it's a love and hate relationship. To this day, we have that relationship, but I know he's still God and that he still wants the best for me. You learn to have a very personal relationship with him. It's not about kneeling down and praying or having a moment of worship, but it's just knowing that God is for you all the time. He is for you. And I think that helps your mentality and your thinking when you navigate life. I think the rest will fall into place by itself when those two principles are pretty solid in your life.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Thank you so much, ma'am. We really appreciate it. I think, like I said, this is part one. There's still a lot to unpack. We are certainly thankful for your time that you've taken to join us this evening. Thank you so much, ma'am, and may you have a very beautiful evening further.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.